This is Network Europe.
Stockholm, Paris, Berlin, Kiev, Ljubljana, Bratislava, Amsterdam,
Warsaw,
Bucharest.
Coming up today, international terrorism is nothing new. A nightmare from the past stirs up emotion in Germany. France looks back as well to a disastrous oil spill as those responsible go to trial. The American green card is familiar from Hollywood, but what about a blue card? We have the details on a new immigration initiative from the European Commission. And they say you can't stop progress, but Poland falls foul of Brussels over a planned motorway through a nature reserve. And save Barcelona's architectural masterpiece, the Sagrada Familia. That's the rally cry from those who want to stop a high-speed rail link in Spain. All these stories and more in this edition of Network Europe, a partnership of Europe's leading international broadcasters. At the helm today from a snow-covered Stockholm, I'm Mark Cummins. Great to have you with us, also in the program.
There was no eyebrow raising, oh my heavens, you know, I'm being followed. Of course you're being followed. You know, you are a foreign correspondent in a communist dictatorship. Of course you're being followed.
A real-life spy saga in Prague for English author Frederick Forsyth. More information a little later in the program. But first, a former member of the left-wing extremist Red Army faction, which terrorized West Germany in the 1970s, has been awarded an early release from prison after serving 24 years of a life sentence. But as Deutsche Welle's Greg Benzoff reports, the German court ruling that Brigitte Mohnhaupt can be let out for good behavior has unleashed a storm of protest across the country.
The Red Army faction, also known as the Bader-Meinhof Gang after its founders Andreas Bader and Ulrike Meinhof, mounted a violent campaign of murders, kidnappings, and bombings from 1977 to 1982 against what it considered to be an oppressive capitalist state. It targeted the German business elite and the U.S. military based in Germany and is considered responsible for the murder of at least 34 people. The RAF, as it was also called, renounced violence in 1992 after most of the group was either killed or put in prison and officially disbanded 6 years later. But the move to release Brigitte Mohnhaupt, who was found guilty for her role in 9 murders, including those of leading industrialist Hans-Martin Schleyer and federal prosecutor Siegfried Buback, has sparked outrage across the country.
I don't think it's enough. I think she should stay in jail because she hasn't served her 5 life sentences. So she should have to stay longer.
Deshalb sollte sie auch noch länger im Gefängnis bleiben.
Ich würde sagen, noch 20 Jahre dazu ins Gefängnis.
I think she should get 20 more years in prison. She needs to stay there. We have enough terrorists in the world.
Wir haben genug Terroristen in der Welt.
Many left-wing politicians, however, from the Social Democrats to the Greens, which in its infancy in the 1970s harbored many sympathizers of the Red Army faction, have welcomed clemency for Mohnhaupt, calling it a chance to turn the page on a dark chapter of post-war German history. But Gunter Beckstein, an influential conservative leader and interior minister of Bavaria, criticized the court's decision. Due to the severity of the crime, he says, I can't imagine that the victim's relatives will feel justice has been done when such people are set free. The kidnapping and murder in September 1977 of Hans-Martin Schleyer, head of the German Employers' Federation, was the RAF's highest profile attack. Schleyer was snatched from his car in Cologne in an attempt to blackmail the German government to release imprisoned Red Army members. His bodyguard, driver, and 2 policemen also died in the attack. Several weeks later, Arab sympathizers hijacked a plane to pressure the German authorities to release captured members of the group. A number of RAF members allegedly trained at Palestinian guerrilla camps in Libya, Algeria, or Tunisia. Former German foreign minister and Green Party leader Joschka Fischer was also known to have visited such a camp. Like Beckstein, the son of Mr. Schleyer also expressed dismay at the court ruling. Many of the victims' relatives, he says, have died, gone insane, or become alcoholics because of those crimes. That should be taken into account. These people trusted the government and thought justice would prevail. It's very difficult to accept this clemency. Meanwhile, another prominent member of the Red Army faction, Christian Klar, is awaiting the outcome of a plea to German President Horst Köhler to be pardoned. Klar and Mohnhaupt were leaders of the second generation of RAF members after Bader and Meinhof committed suicide in prison. neither one has ever expressed any remorse for their crimes.
That report from Deutsche Welle's Greg Bentsov. You're listening to Network Europe. Atoning for past wrongs is a theme in France as well this week. For the first time, those accused of bearing responsibility for an oil spill are being brought before a penal court. 7 years after the ecological disaster which devastated 400 kilometres of France's western coast, the so-called Erika trial started in Paris this week. In 1999, the Erika, a 25-year-old single-hulled rusty oil tanker, sank while transporting 30 tons of heavy fuel off the coast of Brittany. Jail terms and fines worth hundreds of millions of euros are at stake in this trial, which is expected to last 4 months. Radio France International's Nick Champeau went to the first hearings, and he files this report from Paris.
The damage caused by the Erika disaster to the tourism and fishing industries in western France is huge. And under current international agreements, a total amount of 180 million euros can be paid by the International Oil Pollution Compensation Fund, or IOPC fund. But plaintiffs say the damage caused by the oil spill far exceeds that amount. That's why the French state, as well as many local authorities in western France, have brought the case to court. Jean-Yves Le Drian is president of the Brittany Regional Council.
What we want is that companies responsible pay the sums which correspond to their degree of responsibility. They have to pay their share. At a time when everybody's talking about concepts such as ecological pact and eco-responsibilities, we really don't think that taxpayers should be asked to pay the price.
The ecological damage caused by the Erika is also significant. Tens of thousands of birds covered in oil, for instance. That's why lawyers argued this week that in addition to the damage that is easy to evaluate, the harm done to the environment also calls for compensation. In French law, the notion of ecological damage is new. Jean-Pierre Mignard is one of the lawyers defending the plaintiffs. He says it is needed. For weeks and weeks following the wreck, local volunteers mopped up patches of oil from soiled beaches, and their relation to nature as a result has been altered forever. Jean-Pierre Mignard.
I think that the inhabitants will not recover in the future the same feeling of trust they had before.
So how is this going to translate?
It's the same thing because on a judicial point of view, if, for instance, some people are attacked by people, they can be after in a good physical situation, but their mind will not be the same than before. This is the judicial concept of moral prejudice.
The Erika trial will last 4 months. It's quite a complex case. The ship officially belonged to a company from Malta. It was controlled by two Liberian companies, the shares of which were owned by an Italian banker based in London, and the ship's captain was Indian. The problem is that none of the defendants are prepared to pay. The Indian captain did not show up at the trial, and Total, the French oil giant, says it is not responsible because it merely under-contracted the vessel. Yves-Marie Dalibard is communications director for Total.
At the time, there was one vessel available. It was the Erika. It had all the required certificates. We didn't try to strike a good deal. We have under-contracted the ship at the price of the market.
Il a été affrété aux conditions du marché.
That said, on Tuesday, the plaintiffs produced an internal 1998 Total memo, i.e. written before the accident, which proved that Total was aware of its responsibility in case of shipwrecks. Lawyer Alexandre Varro.
Total people knew that they were taking a risk under contracting such a rusty boat. They knew they had to inspect these vessels. They were aware of the risks, but they didn't do anything.
Another embarrassment for Total is that the opening of the trial coincided with the release of the company's profits for the year 2006, 12.5 billion euros. Meanwhile, Rina, The Italian company that gave Erika the seaworthy certificate says it cannot be taken to court because Malta enjoys immunity. Olivier Mesner is the lawyer defending Rina. My line of defense is that the RINA was contracted by Malta, that the RINA did its job, it respected the rules. The contract that RINA signed is a Republic of Malta document. On Wednesday, the judge rejected the argument. Many decisions have been made since the Erika disaster to reinforce maritime safety. Single-hulled oil tankers are now allowed, and old vessels must be inspected each year. These European laws were actually named after the Erika, and an Erika III European package is currently being discussed. But we need to go much further, plaintiffs warned, because profits still come before maritime safety, they argued. Proof is accidents are still taking place. For instance, the Napoli off the coast of England several weeks ago. The trial is scheduled to last until the 13th of June.
Radio France International's Nick Champeur with that report. Coming up...
We think that this is a very important risk to the Sagrada Familia, now or in the future, and for that we ask the administration to change the way of the tunnel.
Protest and progress in Spain. I'm Mark Cummins, and you're listening to Network Europe. The American system of issuing the so-called green card to foreign nationals to work in the United States is something that many of us know through films and television, if not firsthand. Now the European Union has caught on to the idea and is preparing a proposal to issue a European blue card that would make it easier for skilled non-Europeans to live and work in Europe. But as quite a lot of things in our European patchwork of language, culture and nation-state, it's a complex problem and could be a hard sell. Network Europe's resident man in Brussels, Stephen Castle, joins me from our Brussels studio. Stephen, a blue card?
A European blue card, yes. This is the latest idea that's emerging from the European Commission. And in fact, the idea is to copy a number of the things that have been done in the US, where for decades now they've had a green card. And the basis of this system is that American companies, can help people from outside the US to get the rights to live and to work in the US. And once you've got a job in the US, you've got a company sponsoring you, you then get a green card. And that entitles you quite often for a limited period to start with, but quite often for the rest of your life to live and work in the US.
Now, what problem would this solve for the European Union? Are they trying to address a particular need?
Yes, there are two real problems. The first is that there is, over the next couple of decades, going to be a big labour shortage in the EU. I mean, I think the calculation is that over the next 20 years, around 20 to 25 million people are going to leave the labour market. So Europe is going to need more labour. The problem that Europe has had, however, is that a lot of the better qualified people from the developing world tend to head for North America rather than for Europe. And those who turn up in Europe tend, therefore, to be the poorly qualified people without good education. But because of the proximity, for example, Africa to parts of the EU, they then try and come to Europe.
So in a sense, it's almost a way to compete with America for highly educated people from outside both those areas, highly educated immigrants.
Exactly. This is precisely the problem that the EU has. The EU calculates that of people who emigrate and have very few qualifications, 87% of those now head for the EU.
Now, as you say, this is being discussed in Brussels. It seems to be under the radar in Sweden, at least. Is this something that's going to be difficult to sell to the member states?
Well, I think member states will see the advantage of it in principle. They will, I think, appreciate this problem that Europe has of attracting the best qualified people from the developing world. But I think the difficulty they will have is in marrying their own individual, specific, countrywide schemes to a more global European blue card system.
Can we perhaps understand this as a proactive immigration policy rather than Sometimes it would seem to be a passive policy that Europe would be taking in refugees, etc., people that are in need. This is a proactive step, isn't it?
Well, that's right. I mean, what policymakers are trying to do is to get some sort of grip on this problem, because there is an estimate of that around 500,000 illegal immigrants arrive in Europe every year. Of course, this is just an estimate. Nobody knows, because by definition they're illegal. And what the policymakers find themselves doing at the moment is firefighting, trying to deal with the arrival of people in, for example, Malta or the Canary Islands. This is not only a managerial problem, it's a humanitarian problem as well, because people take huge risks to try and get into Europe, and many would-be immigrants have died doing so. So the idea is to shift away from this constant crisis management, to look at Europe's needs, to look at the opportunities that immigration provides for Europe, and to encourage only those people from the developing world who have a chance of getting a good job to make that journey, and to make that journey legally.
Now, governments are one thing, but this is a very loaded issue for many electorates as well. We're facing some elections coming up in the European Union. Is this something that's going to be a hard sell to them?
Well, I think it is, and I think that comes back to this point about national sovereignty and the national debate. Governments are going to really have to involve themselves in quite a lot of the hard sell if this is to go anywhere.
I imagine that it will be something of interest for many of our listeners around the world. Is there some kind of timetable? When are we going to see a blue card?
Well, there isn't a timetable as yet. The European Commission have only just floated this idea. They will produce a document later in the year which will flesh out some of the details. But then it will be up to member states to react to it, and that will be the key point. And already a number of the member states are sounding extremely sceptical, so I wouldn't expect there'd be a blue card in a hurry.
Stephen, thanks for that update. You're listening to Network Europe. Now, as Stephen Castle mentioned there, the European Commission often has trouble making itself heard in the European capitals. And Brussels is currently in the middle of a row with Warsaw over the construction of an expressway running through the unique marshland nature reserve of Rospoda Valley in Poland's northwest. Agnieszka Belowska from Polish Radio's external service has the details.
The Commission was greatly surprised to hear that despite earlier warnings, Poland continues with plans to build the road. The controversial investment runs through the region of the Rospuda Valley, which is currently a special protection area of European Natura Ecological Network, and is on top of shadow list of areas which, according to scientists and ecological organizations, should be designated as special area of conservation. Brussels has demanded to stop the investment until its possible negative effects on the area are cleared out. The Commission spokeswoman, Barbara Helferich.
Until we have legal certainty, our construction should not start under no circumstances. Poland is a member state of the European Union and as such is required to adhere to European legislation. And nature legislation is particularly important for us.
The planned expressway and the construction work will cause environmental damage in that wilderness area. The noise pollution and construction would damage breeding grounds of various bird species, some of which are protected, as well as some endangered plants and the unique Maya complex. Ecologists and conservationists continue to protest against the construction projects. Paulina Dzierża from the Save Wetlands Association.
Until last year, scientists in Europe thought that there is no reference area for peatlands restoration in Europe. We thought that there aren't ecosystems untouched by human in which we can observe how the peatlands functioned in the past in totally natural conditions. But it turned out that there is such ecosystem and that the Rospuda River Valley has a unique European value.
The construction of the bypass is strongly supported by people of Augustów who have to live side by side with the heavy vehicles and trucks continuously passing their town. A solution to the problem could be an alternative route for the bypass road suggested by Poland's Greens and not taken into account by the authorities. The Polish Greens, however, have a strong backing from the European Commission, says Beata Płomecka, Polish radio correspondent in Brussels.
The European Commission supports the Greens because the European Commission started thinking about Drzewuda after all these appeals to the European Commission by ecological groups. Deadline is on the 15th of February, and until that time, European Commission expected that all the works will be simply suspended.
Ignoring Brussels' warnings, Poland's Environment Minister Jan Szyszko decided to start works on the bypass road. What steps will the European Commission take if Poland persists to put a deaf ear to the Commission's demands? Beata Płomecka again.
Then the European Commission starts the infringement procedures. I mean, we'll continue the infringement procedure because the European Commission started the first phase of this procedure in December, and now will be the second time that Brussels sends letter to Warsaw asking for more explanations. Of course, in a couple of months or even next year, the case will simply end in the EU tribunal in Luxembourg.
The Polish Greens and the European Commission are not the only ones who have the interest of the Rosputa Valley at heart. The campaign to save the area is joined by many ecological organizations the world over, though their protests seem to leave no effect on Polish authorities.
Agnieszka Belawska from Polish Radio's External Service with that report. You're listening to Network Europe. Now, infrastructure is at the heart of another controversy, this time on the Iberian Peninsula. While Europe's much-vaunted high-speed train network is expanding, there's still no connection between two of the continent's largest countries, France and Spain. Progress is especially slow in and around Barcelona, where controversy is dogging the project. According to the current plans, high-speed trains will run underneath one of the symbols of Catalonia, the Sagrada Familia, the architect Gaudi's famous and still unfinished cathedral. The famous architectural masterpiece could be under threat. Both the current architects and the neighbourhood residents are deeply worried. Radio Netherlands correspondent Christoph Schmidt has more.
Heavy construction work continues as the clock strikes 11 at Barcelona's Sagrada Familia, probably the most famous landmark of modernist architecture in Europe. The still unfinished Catholic temple, with its pointed towers, is the magnum opus of the late Catalan architect Antoni Gaudí. It receives around 2.5 million visitors every year, but few visitors are aware that the current architects have more urgent troubles on their mind than the often repeated question, when will it be finished? The Sagrada Familia is not the top priority of the national and regional authorities. They are more concerned with the long overdue completion of a high-speed train link between Madrid and the French border, running straight through Barcelona. The authorities have decided that the high-speed trains will run through a tunnel that passes just a few meters from the foundations of the Sagrada Familia. Construction on the tunnel will probably begin next year. A bad idea, according to Jordi Fauli, one of the main architects of the Sagrada Familia. He says the decision puts Gaudi's masterpiece in great danger.
We think that this is a very important risk to the Sagrada Familia, now or in the future, and for that we ask the administration to change the way of the tunnel. There are a lot of possibilities to change.
The main entrance of the Sagrada Familia has yet to be built. When it's complete, it will be the heaviest part of the building, and it'll be situated just above the new railway tunnel. This is asking for trouble, say the architects, but tunnel technicians and politicians disagree. The use of modern drilling techniques will prevent any damage, they say. But according to a local pressure group that wants to move the high-speed train away from the city center, 1,000 buildings around the Sagrada Familia will also run the risk of damage or even total collapse, as happened 2 years ago when a failed tunnel construction gave way elsewhere in the Catalan capital. The spokesman of this pressure group, Pere Vallejo, is convinced that the struggle is far from over and that the continuing protests will succeed in moving the high-speed train project to the coast, far away from the Sagrada Familia.
Lo que hay en la mesa son problemas y problemas y problemas que tienen estos túneles.
Vallejo says that the authorities have failed to respond to the many issues architects and neighborhood residents have raised. He says they refuse to explain why they didn't choose for much cheaper and safer options. And especially because the project is mainly financed with money from the European Union, Vallejo wants a full investigation and more involvement by the authorities in Brussels. The Barcelona railway project is shared on equal footing by three parties, the Spanish central government, the Catalan government and the city of Barcelona. This is another matter of great concern, explains Vallejo, because he believes none of the three will assume responsibility if something should go wrong with the Sagrada Familia, which is on UNESCO's World Heritage List.
What we want to know is who is responsible, who is going to jail if something goes wrong one day. And we think that the most guilty people right now is the city authorities of Barcelona. They have put the most weight into this project, because it goes straight through their house.
Last month, alarm bells rang in El Prat de Llobregat, a town just outside of Barcelona, close to the airport. Nearby construction on the same train project caused cracks in some buildings and in the sidewalk. Some of these cracks look like damage from an earthquake. An older inhabitant of El Prat says people in his neighborhood are worried.
We are not so much afraid as worried that things will get out of hand and that our houses will collapse.
Needless to say, the cracks in these ordinary houses on the outskirts of Barcelona didn't make the international press. But if the Sagrada Familia gets damaged, that would be headline news. This is Christoph Schmid reporting from Barcelona.
Now, before we go, a little information on what you can find on the Network Europe website this week. Recently, a Czech newspaper published details of a little-known footnote in Cold War history. Browsing through the archives of Czechoslovakia's communist-era secret police, the paper discovered that among the foreign journalists regularly followed on trips to Prague was one Frederick Forsyth, today known as the best-selling author of the Cold War classics The Day of the Jackal and The Odessa File. Back in the 1960s, Frederick Forsyth was a young journalist based in East Berlin. Radio Prague's Rob Cameron called the novelist at his home in Hertfordshire, England, and asked him to reflect on his trips to communist Prague at the height of the Cold War.
I got the job as Reuters correspondent for East Germany in September 1963, and the territory also included both Czechoslovakia and Hungary. So you didn't in those days just pick your own hotel, you were allocated hotel. In my case, it was the Yalta Hotel on Wenceslas Square. It was quite clear that I was going to be followed by the secret police. So I realized, because I'd been told in London anyway, that there would be secret police attention. So when it came, it didn't surprise me. Only on one occasion was a sort of almost a breakthrough in relationships when I found myself in eye contact with a very pretty girl in one of the bars. And so I approached and said, could I sit down? Yes. And bought her a drink. Yes, that was fine. And then we had dinner together. And then I had a car. So I suggested we go. It was a very hot August night. I suggested we go out to some lakes north of the city and have a swim. So we did, and they parked up and walked down the meadow and to the lake and stripped off and had a swim, and then I spread a blanket out and we made love. And afterwards I was lying staring up at the stars, and I just murmured, I wondered what happened to my STB escort tonight, and she said, you just made love to it.
A short clip from Radio Prague's interview with the best-selling novelist Frederick Forsyth. If you'd like to listen to the full-length interview by Rob Cameron, log on to our website at www.networkeurope.org. That's www.networkeurope.org. And while you're at our website, you'll find details there of this month's Network Europe quiz. There's still a week to go before I draw the lucky winner. All the information, again, is at www.networkeurope.org. If you'd like to ask a question or send us your comments on today's program, the address to send it to is contact@networkeurope.org. That address, again, it's contact@networkeurope.org. www.newsweek.org. Time's up for this edition of Network Europe. This program is a partnership of Radio France International, Radio Sweden, Polish Radio's External Service, Deutsche Welle, Radio Netherlands, Radio Romania International, Radio Slovakia, Radio Prague, Radio Bulgaria, and Radio Slovenia. Network Europe will be back next week. On behalf of our pan-European team, this is Mark Commons in Stockholm. Thanks for joining us.